History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. There's probably no American whose life has been combed over as much as Abraham Lincoln. There are nearly 20,000 books that have been written about him. But there's still something missed in order to get the complete picture of the nation's arguably the most important and consequential president. And that's the times that he lived in. And antebellum America was crazy. And interestingly enough, there's never been a cultural biography about Abraham Lincoln until David Reynolds' new book, Abe, The Life and Times of Abraham Lincoln. Antebellum America was probably the most partisan, violent, tumultuous time imaginable. It was weak and unstructured, and established institutions were few and far between. The economy was unmanaged, there were bank crashes, thousands of different types of paper money notes flew about, and risk-taking, bankruptcies, and land speculation were everywhere. Even some entire states went bankrupt. This is a rough and tumble world. There were duels, there were rioting, mobbing was commonplace. Alcohol flowed freely, and Americans were drinking more per capita than any other nation, which provoked temperance movements. Fistfights, knifings, and other explosions of violence seemed ordinary and even took place in state legislatures and Congress. Public rhetoric was abrasive and harsh, and sensationalism flourished in the popular press. People were especially eager to read reports of suicides. The nation, it felt like, was coming apart. It was torn by sectional conflict and struggle over slavery. Well, David Reynolds argues in his book, Abe, Abraham Lincoln and His Times, that Abraham Lincoln navigated this world because he was tall and strong, making him a good brawler. But more importantly, he was incredibly bright and easygoing, and he was able to charm those who would just about as likely do him violence. Because he'd experienced American culture in all of its different ways, from the high to the low, the sacred to the profane, the conservative to the radical, this is why he could redefine democracy for all Americans. So we're going to talk about Abraham Lincoln and his world, and also how somebody like Abraham Lincoln could unite America today, even though it seems so bitterly divided. America was more divided in the antebellum era, so there is hope for us now. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with David Reynolds. David, welcome to the show.
Wonderful to be here.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. For viewers who are listening to this on the podcast, they can't see this large tome I'm holding, which for history books approaches the level of a Ron Chernow or a Robert Carroll book. Well, I am excited because I like to think that on this show, I've successfully been able to blend high culture and low culture. Abraham Lincoln is that as well. So I'm speaking with a guest whose book is very likely in the running for a Pulitzer. But on this show, I've also run a series called Presidential Fight Club, where all 44 presidents fight each other one-on-one. Abraham Lincoln, of course, went very far in that contest as a local wrestling champion. And when I was studying that series, I learned a lot about him, that he was a scrappy fighter with Marfan syndrome. He had long limbs, so he was good with that. He was a crude joke teller, and he could spin yarns that could keep people entertained for hours. So for you, David, as a Lincoln scholar and as someone who's extensively looked at his life, was there anything, any little detail or anecdote about his life that really stuck out to you that opened up your eyes to the depth of his character?
Yeah, I think the fact when you mention wrestling, there was a little anecdote about and talk about fighting presidents. He fantasized about wrestling George Washington, who was actually in his youth, like Lincoln, a good athlete. And Lincoln used to say, "Well, I'll bet the guy from Kentucky and Indiana could beat that old aristocrat from Virginia if we got together, had a good wrestle." I think I'd take him on, and probably Lincoln would have, because when the bully of New Salem, Illinois, went up against him, Jack Armstrong, Well, Armstrong committed a foul, so they called the fight a draw. But, I mean, he really stood up to Armstrong and actually won the respect of so many local people because of that. And the kind of wild boys of that era, what were called the huge pod young men, you know, who are kind of, you know, really wild. But they, after that fight and several other fights, Lincoln became widely respected just among the working classes. So I thought that was kind of an interesting little anecdote.
Well, let's enter into the topic of your book. Now, you are writing in a subject field about someone who has, I think, more biographies about him than maybe Jesus, something like 16,000 books. So I imagine just wrapping your mind around the historiography would be a huge right. effort in and of itself. But what you focus on is Lincoln, but not necessarily Lincoln, but the world of Abraham Lincoln. So what caused you to approach a study of him from this perspective?
Well, among the 16,000 plus books that have been written about Abe Lincoln, there are many superb biographies. However, there's never been written a cultural biography. There have been political approaches, and there have been many, many standard biographies which kind of follow his life story and his immediate surroundings and so forth. But I write what I call cultural biographies of people like Walt Whitman, Harriet Beecher Stowe, John Brown, and now Abraham Lincoln. And what that means is that I believe with Ralph Waldo Emerson that we are all profoundly influenced, even psychologically, by the images and ideas from our culture, our immediate local culture, but also the larger culture. Quite often as that larger culture intersects with our immediate culture. And it's that kind of thing that I really try to key into when I write my cultural biographies. And Emerson said about Lincoln, he's really, because he wrote an essay on great heroes and heroism, and he said, the great hero is really open to experience. And he said, above all people, Abraham Lincoln could traverse the entire realm of culture from the highest to the lowest. And even though he had less than 1 year of education, Lincoln, he had long passages of Shakespeare memorized in his mind, and he loved sort of frontier humor, some of it rather dirty and so forth. And he covered the entire range of culture. And that has that particular topic has never been addressed. In fact, one of the finest biographies, David Donald's Lincoln, which came out first in 1995 and became a bestseller. It's a wonderful book, single volume biography. But he says from the very beginning, I'm not trying to recreate Lincoln's times. This is a biography from Lincoln's own point of view. And he was totally a self-made man who entered the presidency least prepared of any president, any other president. And my argument is in a sense exactly the opposite of that, because it's very true he had less than 1 year of education, but he was just so capacious and embracing in his sensitivity to virtually all aspects of the world around him, so much so that Emerson said the very dogs believed in him. You know, I mean, he kind of went from the very lowest to the very highest, and he liked both opera and the most popular songs of his era and minstrel songs and so forth and popular poetry and high poetry. So he's a lesson really in opening one's mind to the full range of culture, which is one reason why he could win the respect of very intelligent statesmen and leaders and so forth. But at the same time, he had a common touch, a true sympathy for the average people. So that's what my cultural biography does.
Well, let's look into the world of young Abraham Lincoln. He's born in 1809. At the closing years of the founding father generation. This is near the beginning of the antebellum era. And the contradictions that are looming on the horizon that threaten the Civil War, you say, are embodied in Lincoln himself, where his father comes from New England Puritan stock. His mother comes from Virginia Cavalier gentry. So his blood within him is the central conflict of the age. So what does that look like in Lincoln's young life?
Yeah, well, in that era, the conflict between the North and the South, yes, it was over slavery, but for the people that lived in that time, they also associated the conflict as between the Puritan New England or Puritan North and the Cavalier South. And the Puritan originally had come over during the Great Migration between 1620 and 1640 to escape the clampdown on Puritanism in England. And generally, they went to New England, the Puritans. And among them was one of his great-grandfathers on his father's side, Samuel Lincoln, who came over in 1837, was a Puritan and helped build a church and so forth. And then slowly the family moved westward to Pennsylvania and then south to Virginia and then to Kentucky, but retaining this kind of Puritan vein all the way through. And on his mother's side, there was illegitimacy there, so he wasn't really sure who his grandfather was, but scholars agree with him because he thought that he came from sort of Virginia gentry, from Virginia, this kind of so-called aristocrat of Virginia, this kind of cavalier. And the cavaliers had this deep sense of honor and personal honor and so forth, along with kind of a belief in institutions such as slavery. But when they were combined in Lincoln, the sort of moral concepts from his Puritan background, moral and religious concepts and anti-slavery concepts from his Puritan background, mingled with this sense of honor from his Cavalier background. However, he was very, even though he was fascinated by his ancestry on both sides, fascinated, he didn't like to talk about it too much. And instead, he emphasized there were a couple of Quakers in his background, or at least he had one Quaker grandmother, and he said, well, we were a bunch of Quakers back then. Why? Because Quakers were actually respected both in the South and in the North. They didn't carry the baggage of the Puritan and Cavalier. They weren't sectional. They weren't divided. They were kind of a buffer. They settled in the middle Atlantic states. And you would think the South would hate them because they were opposed to slavery, but they were not about to go to war over slavery whatsoever. They were pacifists. They were non-resistants. So they were accepted by the South, and they were accepted by the North. So that's what he really emphasized in his personal background. So even though he had these two sides coming together, he didn't really want to separate the wires and even talk about them. He didn't like to use the word Puritan or Cavalier.
Well, I'd love to hear more about how Lincoln negotiates with antebellum society, because this is being recorded in 2020, a few weeks before the election. The big discussion now is how much more partisan the United States is compared to decades ago or even years ago. And antebellum society was incredibly violent. If you didn't know how to expertly negotiate situations, somebody who could be charmed by you or be your friends could easily assault you or even kill you. Very dangerous society. So could you describe antebellum society and specifically how Lincoln's ability to navigate high culture and low culture and everything in between made him successful in this chaotic world?
Yeah, sure. The America of his day was actually even more deeply divided than our America, because what happened is that when he was elected, 11 southern states left the Union and formed their own nation. Then there was a bloody war for 4 years in which 750,000 Americans died. But Lincoln was an excellent negotiator, and he compared himself to Blondin, who was this tightrope walker who walked over Niagara Falls many times, sometimes with a man on his back, sometimes pushing a wheelbarrow, sometimes doing flips, and there was no net. And Lincoln, both by others, was compared to Blondin, and he himself compared himself to Blondin because he felt he had to be exactly in the middle. He couldn't, the era, his age was so divided that if he threw gasoline on the partisan flame, the explosion would come become even worse. If he stepped too far to the right or to the left, then he would fall off the tightrope, and his nation might have fallen off with him. And he gave the lesson that in a deeply divided time, the best one can do is to be a compassionate centrist. He was very compassionate to actually both people on both sides, compassionate to his supporters and compassionate even to those who were opposed to him. And a lot of his generals didn't particularly like him, but he only wanted them to win battles. And a lot of his cabinet members felt superior to him. And he said, "Oh, good. Do you have any other people that you feel superior to me? Please bring them into my cabinet." In other words, personal loyalty was not his measure. The only thing that mattered was loyalty to the vision of keeping the Union or restoring the Union. And increasingly, his vision was to restore it without any trace of slavery, without slavery. So anyone that was useful toward that vision, that national vision, was important to him. Not any sense of personal loyalty and not any base, partisan base or anything like that. Yeah, I mean, his best generals, Grant and Sherman. Grant said, I'm not a Lincoln man. I'm not a Lincoln man. And he even had an enslaved person in his family. Sherman, his other best general, really thought that African Americans should remain in slavery and so forth. And yet, they won battles for the North. They contributed to the North's victory. And Salmon Chase, his Secretary of the Treasury, tried very hard to replace Lincoln in the 1864 election. And Lincoln knew all about that for sure. And yet Chase was very devoted to the vision of retaining the Union and ridding it of slavery. And he did a pretty good job as Secretary of the Treasury. So Lincoln remained committed to the vision of justice for all and union above all and not division. So he overcame personal divisions and personal animosity in the interest of a larger cause. And that's what really distinguished him.
Right. I mean, one point you note is that, I mean, he was a man of his times, and if we want to frame Lincoln in the worst possible light, we can extract quotes out of context and phraseology and framing that doesn't sound polite today in 2020. But you note that he was someone who, at each stage in his life, he managed to arrive at a broader view of things than all but his most enlightened peers. What does that look like? How did he arrive at a broader view of things through different successive stages? And how did he do that?
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Yeah, well, he came of age politically in Illinois, which was a very mixed state. The whole southern portion was occupied mainly by southern people like himself. He had come from Kentucky and then Indiana, but originally Kentucky. And they settled in southern Illinois. And then the northern Illinois, like Chicago, was mainly New Englanders or people from the east. So he had the whole Puritan Cavalier thing working out there. And the division, and then he was kind of in the middle in Springfield, but he was surrounded by a lot of conservative people. And what happened was that Illinois it passed a law in 1853 that Frederick Douglass called the most severe black law, that is to say racist law in the nation. And it said that if you were a free African American, you weren't allowed into the state for more than 10 days. And if you remained there, you had a very high fine. You had to pay a high fine and risk going to jail. So it was a very, very tricky situation that Lincoln, who hated slavery and was fundamentally in tune and in compassion with African Americans, it was very hard for him to advance. So yes, you can cherry pick his early speeches in Illinois, where he's saying, "Well, I never have supported black people serving on juries or voting and that kind of thing." He would sort of perfunctorily say that kind of thing because he wanted to get elected. It turns out that he lost the 1858 Senate election to Stephen Douglas, who was a thoroughgoing racist, which kind of shows you what Illinois was all about at that time. But Lincoln went forward, and yes, he grew particularly during the Civil War, because he so much admired the performance of African American troops in the North in the Civil War. He really, really and if you've seen the movie called Glory, you have a little sense of the dignity and the courage and the self-sacrifice that a lot of these African-American troops exercised. And he very, very genuinely admired that. He also became close to people like Frederick Douglass, who visited the White House. At first, Frederick Douglass thought that Lincoln was too slow on making it an Emancipation War. But when he met with Lincoln, Lincoln explained himself. He said, "If I make it too obviously about emancipation, I could lose some of those border states." Border states were slaveholding states, but they were loyal to the North. And he said, "You know, if I lose Kentucky, I'm going to lose everything. I'm going to lose this war, so I have to be very careful." And Douglas understood it. And finally, in 1864, when they met again, Douglas was very, very impressed by him. And so much so that he said, "You know, Lincoln really was the least prejudiced white person I've ever met, and someone who had the same impression was the aged Sojourner Truth, a feminist African American, who visited him not long before she died. But she said, "I have to meet President Lincoln," and they had a wonderful meeting in the White House, and he called her Auntie Truth, Auntie Truth, and she again left with a very, very favorable impression, as did Martin Delaney. Martin Delaney was an African American that received from Lincoln the highest officer appointment among African American officers, and toward the end of the war, and when he heard that Lincoln had died, he cried for about half a day. Martin Delaney, he was a real black. He was like beyond Black Lives Matter. He was like, radical black abolitionist. He was very, very radical. But he cried for about half a day, and he proposed a monument, a statue for Lincoln's memory, and what was not going to be a statue of Lincoln, but of an African-American woman who is kneeling, and 4 million tears are coming from down her face. The 4 million, and the statue was supposed to be paid for by the ex-enslaved people who are now liberated by Lincoln and by the 13th Amendment. And Delaney fantasized about this statue, with these tears coming out of this African-American woman's eyes, paid for by a penny from each of the ex-enslaved people that had now been liberated. So, it shows you a very kind of different picture than we get if we simply cherry-pick a couple of early speeches by Lincoln in which he was in that very racist Illinois environment.
Well, I'm curious about one thing, and that's Lincoln's type of nationalism. Something that I've talked about with other guests on the show is that the idea of America's collective unity, what is the common story that binds America together? There have been multiple versions of this. You could count Manifest Destiny as one. In antebellum America, many in the South would say that America's collective identity is a racial nationalism. It's a Anglo-American white culture. So this would lead to the ideas that the most humane thing to do with slaves or freedmen is to eventually have them go to Africa or the Caribbean or elsewhere, because the collective identity of the United States is white. Whereas Frederick Douglass supported a civic nationalism that the promises of equality for all of all races are in the Constitution. They just need to be explicated clearly with new amendments, which did come later, like you said. Now, for Abraham Lincoln, embracing this type of Frederick Douglass civic nationalism, the stories make it sound like as if Frederick Douglass put this idea right in Lincoln's head and he had a 180 turn, which of course it's not like that. So where did it come from for Lincoln? Was it his own personal story? Was it Frederick Douglass and others' influence on him? I'm sure it's a complicated mix, but how do you see Lincoln coming to the view that he did about the collective identity of the United States?
Yeah, well, he had to do a sort of a conservative political dance in Illinois. I mentioned that earlier, and he actually endorsed colonization. Although when he endorsed colonization in the 1854 Peoria speech, he was cautious to say immediately that actually colonization meant removal of African Americans from America and sending them abroad. But he immediately said, actually, it would be very, very hard to accomplish that, extremely hard. And indeed, colonization was a very popular idea, but only about 13,000 of 4 million African Americans were actually in the end removed and transported abroad. But he always believed in voluntary colonization, and halfway through the war, he dropped that idea completely. He mainly used it as a political prop. He knew it was virtually impossible. It wasn't going to happen. And at any rate, he said that the colonization would have to be voluntary. And he knew that a lot of African Americans would not support that idea. But actually, the more he grew on the racial issue and the more deeply he appreciated African-American contribution to both the war and to culture, the more he called for political rights, citizenship rights for African-Americans, so that in 1864, the last year, full year of the war, he endorses limited suffrage for African-Americans. And then shortly before he is killed, he comes out, he's the first president to actually come out in public and say, I want the vote to be given to African Americans. And in the audience was John Wilkes Booth, who said that means, he used the word nigger citizenship. I'm going to put this man through. I'm going to kill this. And 3 days later, Booth was a white supremacist and, you know, had a horrible view of Abraham Lincoln, and he killed him. So, in a sense, that very bold call on Lincoln's part, very public call for African-American suffrage, contributed to his assassination, his being assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. But yeah, it was a steady evolution, but it was a very sincere evolution on his part, to be sure.
Something that you note is that because Lincoln had experienced antebellum culture in all of its facets, from high culture to low culture, sacred to profane, conservative culture, radical culture, it made him very, very uniquely positioned to be able to redefine democracy for all people. So to close some of these things out, I want to look at the world that we live in the 21st century and lessons from Lincoln, since you've studied him so thoroughly. Lincoln's, I don't know, he could practically be a living person in your imagination just because you have so many examples of what Lincoln has done. So I have two questions about Lincoln and how it could apply for the 21st century. The second one will be sort of like, what would Lincoln do? That's a broad question. But this first one, what do you think that for someone to be as successful as Lincoln of bringing different people together, they have to experience American culture in its breadth, small town, urban environment? Do you think that that's a necessary prerequisite?
Well, it certainly helped in his case to be aware of culture on all levels. And back in that era, people could actually go into the White House and shake hands with the president. And he called these meetings my public opinion baths. And people would stream, you know, 3 or 4 days a week and spend hours, you know, meeting him and so forth. And he sincerely tried to get interested in each individual case, although he couldn't obviously handle everyone. But there was a genuine sympathy on his part for average Americans. And I think that that's a real prerequisite. Whether it's necessary to know high culture is a different matter. I mean, he just happened to enjoy, he loved Shakespeare. He wasn't like John Quincy Adams, who knew six languages nor was he like Andrew Jackson, who was a populist, but who barely ever read a book. I mean, the thing about Jackson was said that he only read one book through. That was the Bible, and got halfway through a novel, and that was all. You know, he didn't read whatsoever. Lincoln was really, in a sense, in that kind of broad middle culturally, and I think it did help him to have a kind of a democratic imagination. I think that in his case, it really did because what his exposure to people like Shakespeare gave him a certain thoughtful side, a certain meditative side, and that is lacking if you're merely, let's say, into popular culture alone. Let's say you're totally into popular culture. Shakespeare is quite thoughtful, and he was the master of what Melville called the art of telling the truth, with his deep probings at the very axis of reality, as Melville said. So that on April 9th, 1865, which was the day that Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse, everyone around Lincoln, they were on a boat going from Virginia to Washington. And the officials, they were jumping up and down. All they wanted to talk about was, it's kind of like today we would say, mission accomplished, yay, you know, this is great, we won the war, you know, and like a big banner, you know, we've done it, gang. And another president might have said, I've done it, you know, I'm the one who did this. He just wanted to talk about Shakespeare and Longfellow, and particularly about the deeper passages about death and dying, because 750,000 people had died. And his thoughts were really with them at that moment. He knew he won the war. He knew the North had won. But at that particular moment, he would rather think thoughtfully about death and dying and what it meant for all the families. So that when he says in his last major speech, which was the second inaugural, malice toward none, charity to all. He really means that. He really means that. And he had a certain breadth within his heart and with his imagination that really, really reached out to all people.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, yeah. And that's a great example of where I think history can give us hope that however unpleasant things can be happening now, there were more divided times in the past and those were overcome. So there are definite lessons to be learned today. So the final takeaway I'm very curious from your book is, what would a modern day Abraham Lincoln do to bring together very divided people today, the way that the real Abraham Lincoln did in the 19th century?
Well, I think a modern Abraham Lincoln would step, sort of transcend or step over the divide, as Lincoln did, and take an overview of it and not inflame partisan divisions in any way, would try to establish a truly democratic and compassionate centrism, and would try to embrace both sides rather than inflaming either side, rather than playing to a base on either side. And truly, truly try to reach across the political and the human divide. And also, also in a genuine sense, sympathize with people who are suffering. He really had as a boy, he was a very good hunter, but he hated to hunt. He didn't like to kill animals, as opposed to John Wilkes Booth, who shot cats, who used to like to shoot cats. He saw some birds, little baby birds that he picked up and he put them back there in their nest. He had a very tender side, and it seems to me a certain tenderness and real compassion. And during the Civil War, he started crying every time he heard gunshots outside the window, because he said, "This is the day that we have to shoot the deserters, because Northerners who deserted were shot quite often." And he would start crying when he heard that. He hated that. So compassion for the suffering, I think, is something that someone today would do. And kind of moving always toward that compassionate center, seems to me, is what he would do.
I didn't know that about John Wilkes Booth, his sadistic side. Believe it or not, I've had two different interviews on the show about John Wilkes Booth, and we had to argue about how much syphilis influenced his decision to assassinate Lincoln. And when you're having that argument, you can tell you're not really dealing with a high moral character of a person. So, whereas Lincoln is the opposite. Is there anything else that you'd like to stress about Abraham Lincoln or the world around him that you think that, based on your research, can give people a deeper, nuanced view of Lincoln and his times?
Well, since we're on the topic of John Wilkes Booth, no one who has written about him has discussed what I call the American style of acting, which he got from his father. His father was Junius Brutus Booth, terrific actor, but he got so involved in his roles, the father did, that he would literally sometimes chase his opponent outside the theater and continue the fight in the streets. And one night, he, as Othello, he almost literally killed Desdemona on stage, how he had to be pulled off. He got super involved. I could give many examples of that in his roles. And John Wilkes Booth was the only one among the children of Junius who inherited that acting style. And there were a couple of sword fights there where his opponent once had to say, "John, you're supposed to surrender here. I'm supposed to, you know, kill you," and so forth. And once he had a victim on the wheel, the rack, he was torturing. Yeah, and he literally almost tortured the poor person, you know. So he really carried his father's style forward. And he saw himself as playing in a great drama. He literally became absorbed in his role to the degree that when he was fleeing south after the assassination, he wrote in his diary, he said, "Well, William Tell and these other," he had played William Tell, he had played these other villains or killers in his roles. And he said, "They didn't, torture William, get mad at William Tell. William Tell comes out as a hero, or Brutus comes out as a hero." So he was literally identifying with these stage roles. So he takes the American acting style and he puts it into daily life. Yes, he was a white supremacist and all of that, but Lincoln got a lot of assassination threats. He got many, you know, he had a file called assassination letters on his desk. You know, he got so many but Booth literally got absorbed through this American acting style into real life. And he was an actor, of course, and he just kind of carried it out as though this was his greatest part. You know, he got totally absorbed into the role of the assassin, of the tyrant, of the tyrant. He viewed Lincoln as the tyrant. That's just a little thing at the end, but yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point. He seems like the photo negative of Lincoln, where he's so puffed up and egotistical that he lives in a delusional fantasy world, whereas Lincoln's humility gives him compassion for those, and his views are very reality-based because he can take the some of experiences of Americans of very different classes, and it allows him to get a holistic picture of America that not many people would have. Well, there is much, much, much more for people to check out. And the book here is Abraham Lincoln in His Times. So very rich view of not just Lincoln, but the America in which he lived, which I really love that perspective, because sometimes we can silo off a person from their times, which doesn't help us to understand them. And that's how anachronisms creep in. So I appreciate your effort. So listeners can check that out wherever books are sold. And David, thank you for joining us and sharing all this with us.
Thank you very, very much. It's just great to be here. And thank you.
All right. Well, that is all I have to say for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Frieza, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my Spy Masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, or I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged, and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spy Master level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.